new. Okay, so I suppose we should clip these on and be, I assume Commissioner Fish is coming, but I haven't heard he is. No, he hasn't cared about us. Okay, are we ready to get started? Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this council work session on a really important topic. So thank you, Commissioner Saltzman and others who have prepared us for this. I've got a couple of opening remarks. Dan may as well, and others may as well, and then we'll get started. Just want to set the context a little bit for this discussion in that the council this year has already taken some pretty significant steps to address affordable housing along with Multnomah County, and I'm pleased with the work that we're doing and the progress that we've made. We've tripled the multifamily unit limited tax exemption program up to a limit of $3 million. I think that was a positive step. We've directed the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability to streamline the FAR, floor area ratio, bonus system to prioritize affordable housing, and both Multnomah County and the City of Portland advocated, unfortunately, unsuccessfully at the legislature for local governments to be able to have inclusionary zoning policies. So we'll have another opportunity to do that soon. This particular analysis of the costs of constructing affordable housing is a starting point for action on housing over the next 60 days. Which will include this analysis, but also the State of Housing Report Part 2 that's coming to the Council on September 30th, and the housing element of the Comprehensive Plan, which is coming to the Council on October 8th. These opportunities were all going to prepare the Council and the community for discussions about affordable housing resources, namely, are we using those resources effectively? Does the implementation of those resources reflect our values in terms of the level of affordability, the diversity of our workforce, opportunities for minority contractors, sustainable building practices, neighborhood character and quality. So those are some of the community concerns that I think need to be woven into this work. In terms of specific recommendations that are underway or that we might consider, there's some improvements that are needed in design review, not just for affordable housing, but we could potentially lead with affordable housing. Including getting down to quality of materials. There's also the question of commercial prevailing wage, which is affecting mixed-use projects, that is, applying commercial prevailing wages to projects that are mostly residential, therefore makes it very costly to do mixed use, and that's a problem that I'm very interested in discussing and I think is worth solving. And then streamlining requirements and processes in general. So those are some of the topics that I wanted to make sure we had on the table. Commissioner Saltzman, I know you've probably got some more, so thank you.
Thank you, Mayor, and members of council. And I want to thank Multnomah County Chair Deborah Cafori for joining us today. And I think Commissioner Jules Bailey is also going to be joining us, I'm told.
Maybe not. He has another higher priority.
Right. So I think one of the questions that I've been asked, I think, by all of you, is what are the issues around what drives the cost of affordable housing? And I think the mayor, just gave a great overview of some of the drivers, and that's the point of today's briefing. And we're hoping that this brief presentation and discussion this morning will allow everyone an opportunity to have a greater understanding of the cost drivers as they relate to the production of affordable housing. And I particularly want to thank the members of the Meyer Memorial Trust Work Group for joining us today. They are at the table here, and we'll be hearing more from them. And they have been delving into these issues for at least about a year, and they'll share some of their conclusions with us this morning. And so as not to delay our discussion any further.
Dan, let me just make an opening comment, if I could.
And I neglected to have us do introductions, so yeah, please do that.
We'll do that too. First of all, I want to just welcome Kirk Krieger and thank him. He came to visit me yesterday, and I'm going to put in for college credit for the hour we spent talking about this and other subjects. One of the things, though, that we discussed is how do you lower the cost of affordable housing without compromising community values? And one of the things I'm very interested in learning today is specifically what are the things we could do to lower costs? Because we're all about lowering, we all share an interest in lowering costs, because that means we can actually get more units produced. But I think the concern that I keep hearing is that we do so consistent with Portland values. And the three most important values propositions for me are making sure that we pay people a living wage who build housing, that we locate housing in high opportunity areas, and that we not back off Commissioner Saltzman's commitment to sustainable and green building practices. Those are three core values that have guided our work. And the other thing I want to observe is that in this discussion, when we talk about cost, we blur a lot of information. And one of the things I think we have to always remember is that the highest cost housing is also the most needed housing in our community. Because the highest cost housing is the housing plus services that meets the needs of the very poorest people in our community. And if you look at the numbers, it's very easy to say, boy, that's a, you have sticker shock. But if you look at who's on the street and where the need is, we have to be honest with ourselves that the compelling need is around permanent supportive housing. That's housing plus services. It's very expensive. It turns out it's more expensive to let people just die on the streets. So let's, as we have this discussion, let's also remember where the need is, what our values are, and then as we find ways to lower costs and increase production, let's make sure we do so strategically and not in a way that ignores, in my view, the compelling needs in the community. So look forward to the discussion, and thanks for the briefing.
Well, thank you, Commissioner Fish.
Are there opening comments from my colleagues or our county chair before we make the rounds with introductions?
I just have one request, and that's, I'm going to say it before anybody makes the statement. Could we please refer to median income housing as median income housing rather than workforce housing for people who are struggling at two minimum wage jobs who are making maybe 60%, to imply that they're not part of the workforce, I think is unfortunate. And so if we could all refer to what we mean, rather than a generic workforce housing, then that would be very helpful.
Well, Jill, then I think everyone knows the six of us. Why don't you make the start of our introductions among the resource people that are here?
Jill Sherman with Gurning Eveland Development.
Dave Carboneau with Home First Development.
Good morning, Kurt Krieger, Housing Bureau.
And we have a small enough audience that would be useful, I think, if those who are here would introduce themselves.
Larry Jackson, TEC
Mike. Who are you, Mike? You're always here.
Mike Cohen, the Air Security Detail.
Good morning, everyone. And Carla, being quiet is almost everyone knows Carla.
Great. So now I'd like to turn it over to Kurt Krieger, our housing director, who's been here for just a little over 1 month. And this is his first formal appearance here before the city council. So take it away, Kurt.
Mayor, members of council, Chair Kafuri, it's my pleasure today to frame the issue for you. Our goal is to provide both a comprehensive and easy to understand overview of the cost drivers of affordable housing and create a community conversation about potential policy interventions and innovations. So I'll be referring to a series of PowerPoint slides. You've got them in front of you. I'll break partway through the presentation, and Michael will then describe the work of the Meyer Memorial Trust Cost Efficiency Work Group. So to get started, for those in the audience, we've listed the people speaking, their affiliations, and the order of presentation. People talk a lot about the cost of housing, and I think most folks identify with the sticks and bricks, if you will, the hard costs of development. And yet the hard cost of development only constitutes about 77% of the cost. We, in preparing for this discussion, looked at all the national data, all the regional data, and opened a conversation with Meyer Memorial Trust Working Group. The state of California has recently completed an exhaustive review of their database of funded affordable housing projects, about 600 projects throughout the state, including rural and urban areas. And they isolated the different typologies, mid-rise, low-rise, detached, attached housing. The state of Washington went a little further. Actually, the legislature asked the Department of Commerce to evaluate projects funded through the Housing Trust Fund and then to compare them to privately financed market rate housing projects. The Housing Trust Fund is dedicated to people in Washington State with incomes less than 50% of the area median, and that portfolio includes a great number of projects also using low-income housing tax credits. So there's a good proxy comparison for the Washington State study. And they then compared the same typology to privately financed and developed housing so that you could discern the cost drivers of affordable housing separate from market rate housing. So hard costs include those materials, including construction, labor, furniture, fixtures, and equipment, primarily appliances, land acquisition, and the direct attributed cost to land acquisition, as well as hard cost contingencies. And I would say that there is some area for innovation, usually in the modular panelized construction. There are occasionally technology breakthroughs. Your adoption of local code amendments to the Uniform Building Code, allowing the 5-over-1 typology, was a breakthrough, and it has become ubiquitous in the affordable housing world. Soft costs are those costs that oftentimes are heavily embedded in the cost of affordable housing production. For example, soft costs include reserves necessary to attract investor partners to the project. Projects often need debt service reserves of a year's worth of interest and principal payments in order to give the lender a cushion. All projects have architecture, engineering, and environmental costs, so that's no different for affordable versus market rate. Interest carry through the course of construction, primarily property taxes in Oregon, would be a soft cost. Project management is worth mentioning because in Washington State study, they found that project management costs on the affordable side were actually 25% higher than project management costs on the market rate side. And that's because the average affordable housing project has 5 funding sources. So a project manager has to manage construction draws on multiple sources of funds. They have to manage books in a manner that satisfies the investors and the lenders, where a private market rate developer often has their own equity and perhaps one bank in the project. Much more simple to manage that project. Every project has necessary legal fees, marketing costs, and soft cost contingencies. I would say that affordable housing projects have higher than average legal expenses because of the cost of syndicating tax credits, creating the tax credit partnership, and the necessary layered legal review between the investor partners and banks. The third element, which is perhaps the most robust area for local community conversation, are what we call social benefit costs. And these are the elective costs that affordable housing projects carry as the cost of using public funds. Each of those costs are perfectly well justified by policy and practice. The most significant have to do with prevailing wage rates, both federal, state, and local.
Going to run the PowerPoint here?
Yeah.
Oh, you are. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. The social benefit costs of with federal funds, the Davis-Bacon wage rates apply. So if we invest community development block grant funds in a project in anything other than land or landscape materials, it will trigger Davis-Bacon wage rates for the entire project. Of course, state prevailing wage rates also apply. And the other soft cost components include interest, social benefit costs include sustainability, and whether or not certification of whatever life cycle cost standards you are adhering to. Some states require LEED certification for every project, as is the case in Washington State. Other public funds require adherence to guidelines, such as LEED or Enterprise Green Communities guidelines, without the necessary cost of certification. Design review and compliance is a local determinant, and we are sensitive to the fact that that is a community expectation, especially in heritage neighborhoods. But it's also an area that has become somewhat ambiguous and a little bit erratic and hard to predict for designers and developers to comply with moving expectations. There are state and local policies with respect to particular high needs populations, family size housing, perhaps. If you have a special needs population that requires clinical space or community space, those project costs are often embedded in your budget. Increasingly, trip reduction strategies are embedded in the cost of doing business. Those may include paratransit, fairly elaborate bicycle storage and maintenance facilities, and in some cases, cost participation with Car2Go or Zipcar subscriber services to reduce the reliance on individual cars. As mentioned earlier, we have a commitment to green and sustainable building standards, really to achieve life cycle cost premiums. Those would include community gardens, green roofs, and green walls. There are women and minority-owned disadvantaged small business compliance expectations and apprentice and workforce development and training participation requirements.
Before you go to the next slide, in your handout, under social benefit cost components, you don't list opportunity. Is that because you view it as falling under a different category or as not technically a social benefit cost driver?
Well, you know, I mentioned it in our hard cost vis-a-vis land costs because it is important to note that many public policies require access to transit or transit-rich locations. It's a cost driver for site selection. In fact, in California, you cannot get an allocation of tax credits unless you're within a half mile of a transit station or a high-capacity transit stop. So I would say that it's embedded in the hard cost for land, but it is a highly variable cost from one location to another. We are committed to distributing affordable housing throughout the city to make sure that we don't have disparate impacts or any sort of disconnect between opportunities, employment, education, and training. So I didn't list it out in the PowerPoint, but it is in the narrative report as a cost driver.
And the reason I think it may be useful to have this also under social benefit is that the most frequent email that we get around affordable housing is someone questioning why are we building affordable housing in South Waterfront, Southwest Portland, other what we call high opportunity areas where, frankly, the dirt's more expensive than if we go to the fringes of the city. And I think Dan has been eloquently explaining that in terms of we're committed to opportunity, and we want families, low-income families, to have the same choices that that middle-income families have about where you live and send your kids to school. But there is a conscious decision that we're willing to spend a little bit more for the dirt to create opportunity. So I think I would just caution against burying it within the hard cost analysis, because there is there's a clear policy values basis behind that decision. It isn't just because HUD has said it's a primary value. It's because our community has said we want to promote opportunity. So, and I think the public needs to understand why the extra investment in a high opportunity area gets a better return in some instances. The return that Deborah talks about is a higher performing family, kids that do better in school, people that are quicker to get out of poverty rather than being economically segregated. So I offer that as an observation because I think I think it is a clear social benefit that we focus on opportunity.
It's an excellent point, and banking land where high-capacity transit improvements are planned before stationary locations are determined is key. There was a really good economic study in the Phoenix metro area looking at Mesa, Tempe, and Phoenix, and they baselined the land values before the Valley Metro station was put into effect. They activated 52 stations all at once in 2009, and the stations in and around Tempe actually experienced a 1,600% increase in land value. The areas in industrial heart of Phoenix near the airport only experienced a 350% increase in value. So the positioning of land acquisition prior to the speculative premium is quite important. It's one of the reasons why land banking is seen as a good investment of public funds in those transit-rich locations.
So, under the target populations, you don't list people accessibility for people with disabilities. Is that because it's the same level of accessibility in private versus in public?
There is a baseline requirement in state code, which everyone must meet in multifamily housing. As a matter of public policy, often public funders will exceed those standards. My last position was with Fairfax County. We actually were doing 100% handicapped adaptable units in transit station locations. We were paying for that as we procured developers and interested developers in those sites. As we did permanent supportive housing with an economic life of 80 to 100 years, we wanted to make sure that those units were adaptable for people so that the turning radii in the bathrooms and the kitchens were already predetermined to be accessible for people with wheelchairs, even though we may not have people with disabilities in those units. That was a local preference.
And that takes more space. So I'd like to see that specifically called out under the cost-benefit analysis. Thank you.
Right. And frankly, designed into the property, it's, of course, much less expensive. That's why we wanted to make sure it was built into the procurement of developer partners for those projects. So that's a quick summary of the cost drivers, hard costs, soft costs, and social benefit costs. And Michael Parkhurst is going to describe the Meyer Memorial Trust Cost Efficiency Work Group's efforts, and then the group will join.
Thank you, Kurt. Mayor Hales, Chair Kafoury, members of the council, it's my pleasure to be here today to describe our year-long effort to grapple with these same issues. It's gratifying that I think what you're about to hear from us overlaps considerably with what Mr. Krieger just presented. I'm sorry to say we don't have our final written report yet. I'm sure you're chafing at the bit to read the 30-page report. It won't quite be ready until about October 1st when we're doing a public rollout of the work, but I'm happy to give you a preview today. Meyer convened a 5-year affordable housing initiative. We're in the second year of that. We're committing about $16 million over the 5 years across Oregon, focused around 8 strategies and really 3 major conceptual priorities: preserving the affordable housing we already have, looking for ways to increase affordable housing across the state, partly by innovation and partly by looking for ways to identify new resources. So the reason for this cost efficiencies work group, I think, is pretty self-explanatory, and people have already hit on it. We need more units. If we could build units less expensively, we could get more units on the ground. So there's been a lot of interest in this. It's sort of a perennial topic, as Mr. Krieger said. Do I have the clicker? Sorry. And we need to switch over. Oh, you know what? I just realized I've given you the handout. We're not doing a PowerPoint on the screen, so I don't need the clicker.
You need to switch over.
My mistake. That's just old habits. Anyway, so you have the presentation in front of you. We'll run through this fairly rapidly. Feel free to interrupt me with questions. This can be fairly informal, and I'll have my colleagues who work with me in various places. The work group itself was 16 individuals with a lot of experience in housing development that we recruited from a variety of different perspectives, including for-profit developers who work in market-rate housing, architects, consultants, nonprofit developers, really got a great mix of folks, a couple of lenders, and I really want to thank everybody who participated in this. They put a lot of time, thought, and effort into this work. We asked them to do 3 things as part of this work. We asked for a clear, simple explanation of the cost drivers, pretty much like Mr. Krieger just delivered, a short list of recommended policy or systems changes that would help deliver lower-cost housing, And then finally, we wanted some advice on efforts Meyer could make to roll out some pilot funding to promote lower cost approaches to housing, which we're about to do. I want to tell you just a bit about my background so you know what my limitations are. So I've been a funder on the public side. I've been involved in deals from that point of view, and I'm comfortable reading pro formas, but I've never put together a tax credit deal. I have not hired subcontractors. So at various points in this conversation, I'm going to rely on my colleagues here if you have technical questions. We had five headline findings that are on the third slide, and essentially this boils down a year of very intense, very complex conversations into one slide. And I'm going to run through these in order, so I won't read these to you at this point. And I do have a slide here later in the presentation that specifically addresses issues that are under the city's control. So comparing costs between different kinds of projects is difficult and complex. Details and nuance really matter. And that's one of the headline takeaways that I want to make sure everybody understands. And I think I've heard each of you sort of address that in the course of this conversation. So if you're making meaningful comparisons between projects, you can't just divide the total development cost by the number of units. That's a recipe for confusion every time. Things like the cost of land, the type of construction, whether there's non-housing space involved in it, the unit mix, the unit sizes, life cycle costs, all those things complicate comparing projects. That explains why the group opted not to try to answer the question, what should a project cost or what should a unit cost? We don't think that's a question with a meaningful, simple answer. So you won't find that in the report. We did talk a bit about what's the right metric if you're trying to compare and if you're trying to make these more subtle comparisons. Is it total development cost per unit? Is it per bedroom? Is it per square foot? You get different answers if you use different metrics, and it's not obvious what the right one is. Maybe you should use a life cycle metric. Should you talk about per bedroom affordability years per public subsidy? That's not a crazy idea, and it would get you a much more nuanced answer to the question of what are we buying. The second big takeaway we had for you is affordable housing is really different than market rate development. They share a lot of things. You're still building a building, and the building may look very similar from the outside, but the process is really different. And probably the biggest reason is this is a very strange business. We are building something for customers who can't afford to pay the cost of the product. So you have a gap built in on the front end because we set the rents to be affordable for people at lower incomes. That means you don't have enough money to build the product. But there are two other things that are not really obvious that extend from that. One is you have a problem with operating costs out in the future as your rents are capped and your expenses are not. So you have to plan for that. And then when it comes time to recapitalize the project, when you have to fix the roof or replace the HVAC or do other major repairs, for a market rate developer, they can usually sustain that out of cash flow. It's not necessarily true for an affordable developer, so you have to build in capitalized reserves for that. All those things tend to increase the costs. And then, as we've talked about here already today, taking a public dollar tends to increase the cost. They come with social benefits, which Mr. Krieger pretty aptly summarized, so I don't think I'm going to repeat that in a lot of detail. Just pursuing the subsidy, though, I don't think we mentioned much about. So to apply for 9% tax credits from the state, which is one of the biggest sources of subsidy, especially if you're reaching lower affordability levels or lower income levels. That's a complex, difficult, expensive process just to go and compete for the funds, and you might have to do that two or three or, God forbid, four times before you get the tax credits so you can actually move forward on your project. So that tends to add to costs. We have a note in here about scale. So most affordable projects tend to be small for a variety of reasons. And so you get a diseconomy of scale. You have very complex projects with many funding partners, but you're spreading those fixed costs, essentially, things like legal are fixed costs. You're spreading them over a smaller number of units. $75,000 over 40 units is really different than $75,000 over 150 units. And I think sometimes we lose track of that. Supersizing projects is not a panacea. There are reasons why that might not be appropriate. You're not going to be able to do that necessarily outside of an urban area. So that could work in Portland, but you're also going to need more subsidy to build bigger projects, which means you might do fewer projects, which has other implications. Another big takeaway we don't want to lose sight of, and I think Commissioner Fish addressed this very well, is we're doing more than just building people storage boxes here. Affordable housing is not just housing. And I think that's really critical to keep in mind. There's a mission to serve people. There's a mission to address other needs at the same time. We also put expectations on these projects about neighborhood revitalization and other broader social goals. that a market rate developer may not have to deal with. And that, an analogy that occurred to me recently, and this is a little bit extreme, but I don't think it's completely off the mark, is when the city buys an ambulance or a fire vehicle, we know that's going to cost a lot more than a baseline Ford Econoline van, because they're not the same vehicle. They don't serve the same function. So let's not compare something like Bud Clark Commons to a private market rate apartment building, because they're not really the same and they're not doing the same thing. And then the fourth takeaway we had is the current delivery system for affordable housing includes cost as a priority, but not one of the highest priorities. I can't look you in the eye and say if two projects came in that were really comparable and one was 20% less costly or required 20% less subsidy, that the less costly one would get funded every time. And I think there are a variety of reasons for that. Part of it is we've learned the hard way against cutting corners up front. We've learned that can bite you in the end when you have to come back and recapitalize the project early. I mean, nobody wants to do that. Part of it is we've added these social benefits requirements in increments over time, and they've sort of stacked up, and no one's really stepped back to say what's the aggregate impact of these things. And so there are a lot of points that come into something like the tax credit application, for instance, that tend to bury the points you would get for being cost efficient. And so cost efficiency, everyone I've talked to says it's in there, but it's not a major factor. So if you want to make it a major factor, that would take some changes. And we'll talk in a minute about, I would say, any refocusing about reprioritizing costs and raising that as an incentive. It needs to be done in a very thoughtful, careful way. Finally, I would say, as long as we are stuck in a world where tax credits, and particularly 9% tax credits, are the major source of big equity in a project, it's going to be very, very hard to reduce costs very much. We can play with this a bit at the edges. There are some policy things that make a difference. But if you're doing a tax credit project, you are going to be doing a project that's pretty expensive. There are some things that are just baked into that.
Michael, can I make a suggestion? There's a lot of smart people in this room that understand the tax credit market. We're going to be talking about tax credits as a component. Could you give a 30-second overview of tax credits and how they work, just so we have a baseline understanding?
Thank you, Commissioner. I'm going to defer to one of my brilliant partners. Either Jess or Jill would probably be good to take that one on.
So,
tax credits in 140 characters. Let's see.
Challenge. So it's a federal program for affordable housing specifically. It is a tax credit that is given on a per capita basis to each state, and then the state allocating agency, which is OHCS, or Oregon Housing Community Services, and the state of Oregon, then delivers those to developers to develop affordable housing through a very competitive process. And it really is just a dollar-for-dollar tax credit that the developer, if they win, they receive it, and then they actually have to go out and find a buyer for those tax credits, which is typically a bank, say, for example, Bank of America, who you negotiate with, and they buy it so they can reduce their tax credit liability. And that is how affordable developers through the tax credit program get their equity. So it is, as noted, a very complicated, complex program that works, but it does not work very inexpensively.
I have to say, I think that was the most clear and succinct statement of the case I've heard since Jill Sherman did Development 101 for Dummies. So thank you very much.
Well done. Well done.
So, you know, the things I would call out in what Jessica just said are it's very competitive. So the state gets at least twice as many applications every year, maybe three times as many, that are really solid, excellent projects. It gets at least three times as many applications as it has tax credits to fund. So really good projects where people have worked really hard to put them together have to come back the next year and then hope that they will rise to the top in another brutally competitive environment. Another thing we didn't really talk about is there's a long compliance tail that follows that money. So for 15 years, you're documenting the rents of everybody that lives in that project, and there's a cost that comes with that as well. So tax credits are great because they give you equity, which is private money from outside of the state of Oregon going into these projects, but it costs more to use that money and access it, and it's not very flexible. So if there were more flexible sources of money from the state or from other local funders or from Meyer Trust, developers could do different things. And I think A great illustration of that is what Dave Carbonell and his partner Rob have done with Home First Development, where they've decided not to take a public dollar, essentially, and they have been able to make a bunch of decisions that Jessica cannot make in a tax credit deal. So more flexible money would be a good thing. The cost drivers, I will go very quickly through this, but I'm going to give some of my colleagues a chance to jump in on these. We've covered the cost drivers in some detail already in Mr. Krieger's presentation, and we devote a big chunk of the report to summarizing those, leaning sometimes on some of the other good reports that have been done around the country that Mr. Krieger mentioned. Hard costs is probably the simpler side of the conversation. If you're building the same kind of project, it should cost roughly the same. One of the big caveats there is prevailing wage does make a difference. And if you are in a commercial prevailing wage situation where you're doing a mixed-use project and Boley decides commercial applies to the whole project, the Bureau of Labor and Industries, then that is a big cost increment. And maybe this is a good time to turn it over to Mr. Steffen, who knows more about construction than I ever will.
That's fine. I'll talk specifically about our area of expertise at Walsh, which is the construction costs. I'll talk about those costs as they relate to what I'll call the current mainstream delivery system, the tax credit system. And Dave, I think, we'll chime in on what's related to the alternative delivery system he's been working with. So Kurt's pie chart shows about 75%, 77% of the total project cost being related to hard costs. Those construction costs specifically are around 60%. So the land acquisition is that other 15% chunk. So, materials and labor and the equipment used to install the equipment is really about 80 to 90% of that 60% construction cost. We've got general conditions, which is our supervision, temporary facilities for construction, hoisting and such. That's another 7 to 10% of project cost, construction cost. Contractors' fees, the overhead and profit ranges, but 2 to 6%. Insurance is another 1 to 2%. And then on that hard cost contingency, often that's held completely by the client or the owner, but we often carry 1 to 2% of the project cost. Because plans aren't perfect, we are expected to kind of take care of that little bitty increment, and we can control that. So that's sort of what we call the general contractor's cost contingency. If we look at the building as a combination of site development, or the project as a combination of site development and vertical construction, we can look at the site development itself being a range of 5 to 20% of overall construction cost, and the vertical component to be 80 to 95%. So that can vary quite a bit, and that really relates to the variability of sites. Some sites are really easy to develop, flat, no contamination, good bearing capacity, no groundwater, but sites that are burdened with that, which tend to be a lot of the sites in the opportunity areas in the central city area, they tend to have a lot of costs related to that site development. So that in itself is a big cost driver that is variable between projects. So that's a rough overview of the hard construction costs for standard affordable housing. The real answer to the question, what does affordable housing cost to build, is it depends. And because there's a really large range, depending on the parameters, programmatic requirements of the project. Michael mentioned the services that go with projects such as Bud Clark Commons compared to just a standard market rate project. I brought, just to illustrate, spreadsheet that none of you can see the numbers on, but this is very interesting in the sense that
I think there's a mistake in the third column.
This is 50 projects, 5 over 1, a little bit more than 50, 5 over 1 project types. That's that specialty housing type we do here in Portland. It's market rate projects, it's affordable projects. It's mostly projects over the last 5 to 6 years. We have some historical cost data from the decade before that, but what's interesting here is the range of
square foot cost for these projects is anywhere from $113 per square foot to $201 per square foot. And that's for two 504 projects in the city of Portland. One is downtown, one is out 33rd Broadway. Actually, both of those are market rate projects. And you can see there's just a lot of variability for the basic construction type there. So of the 60% of the pie that we talk about it being the construction cost, I think it's possible that 5 to 10% reduction in cost could be achieved through what I would call more efficiency and more constructability driven into the design of the project. So that's more simpler forms, more compact space planning, more standardization, and those are things that we often don't see because we're striving for some of the other values, like being very responsive to neighborhood context. And, you know, architecturally, we have very high quality buildings. They are well built, they're spatially generous, and they often include significant amenities. So we could look at taking those out of these projects to reduce costs of an order of 5 to 10%, but those are choices that in general, especially on a social benefit side, we don't tend to make. So with that said, I'll take a few more minutes to talk about...
Before you move on, do you know what the range of profit for the developer is?
Actually, I'll defer, because when talking about soft costs, I think that kind of goes into that category. And I'm sure Jill and Jessica can hit on that.
You want to talk about it now?
Well, Let me finish with just a few comments about social costs, what Kurt sort of itemized as social costs, and we took stock of how valuable those social costs are. But they do have effect on construction cost. Prevailing wage tends to add about 10 to 15% to costs on our residential low-rise projects. On our more urban center city, mid-rise, high-rise projects, that premium is not nearly as high because the subcontractors that are bidding that work and involved in that work tend to be union, or they tend, if they're not union, they're paying their workers higher wages as a tenancy. Sustainability and green building, if we're talking about lower level certifications, that premium is in the range of 1 to 3%, so that would be like a LEED Gold. If we're talking about higher level certifications, such as LEED Platinum or Passive House or the Living Building Challenge, now we're talking about 5 to 12% premiums on projects from a construction cost. And that's not talking about the soft cost premium that goes with those. Design review, if it's requiring changes to building form, exterior materials, or site development, landscape, urban design improvements, that can add significant cost. Construction cost. The requirement to use certified firms, utilization, the 20% requirement really on smaller projects where the base, sub base that can serve those projects is quite wide. We don't see a lot of additional costs related to hitting 20%. To push to 30%, certainly to push to 40%, we start seeing some cost premium, but it's relatively minor on smaller projects.
Talk about a premium for sustainability. How do you account for return on investment? You're talking about the upfront cost.
Talking about first cost solely. And
But if the pro forma from the project says that it's going to save, you're going to save X dollars in energy costs over the life of the project, how do you factor that in for the purpose of our discussion?
It's a very important part of the discussion, and that is a driver for organizations like REACH and even Gertie Neelan working in the private sector. That's very important.
Do you want me to? So there's a couple ways that comes into play. First of all, in many cases, when you are targeting rents to be affordable to a household earning a particular percent of area median income, the way you figure that out is to go through the math to figure out essentially what 30% of their gross income is to determine what's affordable for them. And then you're deducting a utility allowance that's typically based on something that the local housing authority puts together for new construction or existing buildings, and it's meant to describe what you'd expect people to have to pay. You have to deduct that from what you can charge them for rent. So in other words, any tenant-paid utilities need to be deducted from the rent so that their total occupancy cost, if you will, so their rent plus any utilities they're paying, equals that 30% affordability mark, 30% of their gross income. So what happens is if you make investments in the project and you lower the cost to the tenant, there's definitely a benefit to the tenant. I do think it's possible if you can prove out over a few years that you have actually saved that money or the tenants are saving that money, then perhaps you could have a discussion about whether you could increase the rent to, if you wanted to do that, to make it still the same affordability. Otherwise, you're getting more affordability to the tenant, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but isn't benefiting the owner, who's the one that paid for that additional upfront cost. We also have extremely inexpensive electricity in our state, which means that while certain types of investments are very easy to pay back in a reasonable amount of time, when you start to look at the what I would call the deeper green, so to get to passive house, to get to living building challenge, and really push the envelope on the sustainability front, that does not typically have what we would consider kind of a market rate payback period.
The social, the last one I want to hit on is the apprenticeship and workforce training requirements. Those, the way that those costs are handled really on the by the subcontractors, from our experience, is they bid the work based on their standard productivity rates and expectations, and the apprenticeship workforce requirements are sort of add-ons. So when they have additional personnel, these are new hires, they don't know what they're going to get out of those folks. They're hopeful they'll get good productivity, but they tend to hedge against the downside of a bad hire by just not counting that into their rates. So they're going to bid the job based on what they think it takes and then add the one or two people or more that are going to be involved in the project in that program to their number. So last thing I'd like to say is there's an intangible impact of some of the social policies on the construction market and the pricing that we get from the subcontractor base. We've got a great, it's a wide, deep subcontractor base across the Portland area, a lot of enterprising firms, many of them are certified. Their appetite to bid the work that we're involved with these social overlays, is reduced. And in this environment right now, where there's so much market rate work going on, there's so much work available out there that's unencumbered, is not burdened with the requirements. They're looking at that work, they're bidding that work, and they're tending to avoid bidding our work in that niche. And what we don't know is, did we lose, you know, if we had 15 potential subs in drywall, did we only get two bids because only five firms were even interested of even thinking about it, and we only got two bids? Where in a different marketplace, you could get 15 bids in drywall. So how does that play out? We really don't know. But we do know that there's a deterrent effect that comes from the burden of the additional requirements that come with the public funding. And with that, Dave, maybe it's good for you to tag on about your approach.
Just to put this in context, when I walked into the room with Meyer Memorial Group, and it was one of those experiences where you thought you were in the wrong classroom, and you know, you were there for about an hour, and you said, what am I doing here? And I think what we determined that there wasn't necessarily a right or wrong answer to any of our approaches, and that it wasn't an either or, that we need both of these approaches to be able to start fulfilling the gap in housing. Having said that, as I look at the construction side, right now we finished a project where our cost came in around $5,000 a door, around $80 a square foot. And so just keeping that in mind, I kind of point to three areas where I see some significant differences. And again, the driver here is that we have, through our partner, Portland Habilitation Center, access to private equity. And so we don't have to jump through a lot of the hoops. that are associated with public financing. But there's three major things. I mean, first of all, we have standard designs. We're doing primarily three-story wood frame construction. And it gives us a certain amount of predictability and repetition. If we're doing the same thing over and over again, we get better at it every time we do it. And we have a lot more familiarity with the projects. The second thing is, and I think you, Mike, alluded to this, is we can hire small independent contractors. And as you pointed out, we're finding many contractors who do want to work on projects that aren't encumbered with a lot of the social initiatives that go with workforce training and so on. And I think the third thing, and I think this is an important element to keep in mind, we can build a project in 9 months, the construction side. We can find a piece of land, we can do the designs, albeit standard designs, we can be through permits, hopefully we can get through permits in 3 months, and ready to construct in. Usually it's about a 9-month cycle for construction. So from the time we identify a piece of land to the time we're fully occupied is about a 15-month process. And some of the projects that are driven by protracted financing and multi-source financing, they can take up to 4 years. And that's a cost. It's a huge cost. Hard to quantify sometimes, but nevertheless, it does add up. Those are the three primary factors that I think differentiate our two approaches.
Steve, I have a question
sure.
Just following up on that. We, by policy, typically look to have 60-year covenants on the housing that we invest in.
So when you do a pro forma and one of your developments, what's the life cycle for the housing? And then how do you build in the costs of rehabbing it after the first 15 years or so, and how does that affect your cost structure?
I think Sony mentioned this in the context of talking about a market rate. We have been able to develop costs, and our rents are at a level that allow us to generate enough margin that can be redeployed into the projects over time. So while we don't necessarily capitalize a reserve for future repairs and so on, the cash flows that are generated from the projects are sufficient to take care of those as needed. So that's the primary difference. I think most of the banks, and Jessica, Jill can refer to this, are going to look for that money up front in some respects, where we're able to amortize that over the life of the project. I think there was two questions in there. I think there was...
What's the life cycle of that? What's the contemplated life cycle of the housing? When does it have to be substantially?
You know, that's a tough question. You know, I look at a lot of the wood frame construction that was built out back out in East County over, you know, Joel West built a lot of projects over the 60s and 70s that are still in good repair and still serving a need of that community. So I could say we'll certainly get 60 years. I think wood frame has stood the test of time over the years.
I was curious why you'd build a three-story standard design as opposed to four or five stories. Is there
just a certain level where we can stay within kind of a sweet spot for what we're doing? It's a very efficient construction.
No elevators.
That's the other one. Thank you.
Code change. Yeah.
Yeah. So you get to that next level, and there's some incremental costs that just kind of push it to the next level of construction that we can avoid.
So the one other thing.
Could somebody please answer my question about developer profits?
If you're willing to wait just one more slide, we'll finish up on hard costs. Or should we do it now? You want to do it now? Let's do it now.
Most eager to answer your question.
I don't want to keep
it.
It seems
to me like this is part of the. It's coming. It is coming, and we'll just jump ahead, and I'll start, and then just if Jessica, if you want to chime in. So in a market rate development, there are typically three components, if you will, to developer profit or money, which is going to be a developer fee, which is a project cost and is typically a percentage of the hard and soft costs of the project. And then there's cash flow over time, which is just what you have after you collect your rents and pay your expenses and pay any debt service that you have. And then typically in a kind of market rate scenario, you also look at a profit upon sale. So you're planning to hold the asset for a particular amount of time, and then you guess what it might sell for at that time, and value has appreciated over time. And then once you pay off any debt you still have on the property, that's profit. And so there are those different components. So affordable housing differs kind of on all three. So developer fees for affordable housing do tend to be higher than in market rate development. And that's, I think, because in many cases, the other two components don't exist. There is not cash flow or significant cash flow over time. The project's really, this is a new construction project, has really been underwritten so that you have your tax credits, some other gap funding, and then probably the city as the major, the Portland Housing Bureau, as your major gap funder. And typically there's some split of cash flow over time to repay the funds, at least to some extent, from them. And then there's some amount of cash flow. And it's really almost the cushion that's required on your debt from your lender, your debt service coverage ratio. So that 20 or 25% is really what that cushion is in that cash flow over time. So it's not significant. And most affordable housing developers, and particularly the nonprofits, are planning on owning the asset, you know, forever. So they're not really looking at that there's going to be a something that's going to trigger a sale and any profit associated with that in the future. So, you know, when a lot of for-profit developers, I think, who do affordable housing look at doing affordable housing, the ability to get a somewhat higher developer fee is important because they're not going to have that cash flow over time or those other sort of profit centers, if you will. Did you want to add anything, Jessica?
I would just add that the developer fees we're allowed to take in affordable housing are restricted by the public funders, and that can just range anywhere, I think, depending where you are, 5 to 15%. I would say our average, I mean, we have taken, like, the Allen Fremont project that we recently did. We took zero fee on that for social reasons. And we have gone as high as 15% where we're allowed to in 4% tax credit deals. But I would say an average for us on a tax credit project is probably in about an 8% range, to just give you an idea of that fee. And like Jill said, I think that was really worked into to the financing structure of affordable housing, knowing that there really will never be an upside for affordable developers. We will never sell. There's no mechanism that we can take the cash flow back very easily, or if there is any cash flow, it's very small.
Thank you both. That was helpful. And I think obviously there's a fairly big difference between 8% and 15%. As a profit, so that's something that should be on the table. Maybe it's in a lighter slide as one of the variables that we might be able to do something about.
So I maybe Jill said this and I missed it, but the other thing that's important to understand is the developer doesn't always realize that developer fee in cash. It's deferred sometimes. It's also the contingency of last resort, so if something unexpected comes up, the developer fee is that last bucket of money you can dip into. And so I know I've seen, you know, several projects where that developer fee did not come true for the developer at the end of the day.
Each step of the way, from the prime contractor all the way down, everybody is making a profit, and it's interesting. It would be good to look at other ways to give a reasonable return for the work and still make sure that the public gets their money. Because I'm thinking back over the course of the recession, where companies were bidding pretty much at cost in order to keep their workers employed, versus now when there's a lot of work and they're able to charge market rate to that. And if there's a way on socially responsible public investments to encourage developers and others to not donate their time, but certainly to cut as a break for the public good, I think that would be something to explore.
I would also just note one really complicating factor of the developer fee in affordable housing. And so when I mentioned we're taking in a deal we're doing in Washington State, we're taking 15% developer fee. Is a 4% tax credit deal, which is different than a 9%. And the reason we do that is because it actually helps the economics of the deal. We get more equity.